Good afternoon. I want to welcome you to today's conversation on climate change policy. I'm Jeff Wood, co-chairman of the Nashville chapter of the Federalist Society. Today's event is co-sponsored with the Vanderbilt Climate Change Research Network, as well as the Environmental Practice Group of the Federalist Society. Today's event is hosted by the law firm of Bradley Arant Bolt Cummings. We greatly appreciate them welcoming us today, providing these wonderful facilities and providing lunch. And our event is also moderated by Brooke Smith, who's a partner here at Bradley Arant and is particularly interested in sustainability issues, as well as the currently the chairman of the TVA's real estate section. I also want to take a moment to thank Justin Adams from the law firm of Trauger & Took, who has helped coordinate today's event and putting that on. And if you picked up a CLE form, be sure to fill that out. Justin's taking care of making arrangements so that everybody here who's a lawyer who wants CLE credit can get that. Either leave your form on the table, or Justin, if you'll raise your hand back there, you can give the form to Justin. He'll take care of that. So, thank you. Concerning our sponsors, the Climate Change Research Network is affiliated with the Vanderbilt Institute for Energy and Environment. The Research Network includes a team of researchers, faculty, and graduate students who are conducting theoretical and applied research on one of the most widely overlooked sources of greenhouse gases, individual and household behaviors. As part of this process, the Climate Change Research Network has been studying ways individuals and businesses can reduce their own carbon emissions, as well as the kinds of changes in laws and policies which would be needed to generate cost-effective reductions in greenhouse gas emissions from individual behavior. We're pleased to have Professor Vandenberg, who is currently the director of the Vanderbilt Climate Change Research Network, with us today. The other sponsor of today's event is the Federalist Society for Law and Public Policy. This is a nationwide organization of 40,000 lawyers, law students, scholars, and business people who, while diverse in their viewpoints, seek to raise awareness of concepts of limited government, individual liberty, constitutional governance, and the rule of law. To that end, the Federalist Society functions primarily as a debating society. Like today's event, we seek to sponsor fair and serious open debates about a wide range of important issues of law and policy. Within the membership of the Federalist Society, you will find ardent critics of modern climate science, as well as others who, like Professor Adler, who recognize that laws mandating greenhouse gas emission reductions most likely lie ahead, and who see the need to be part of the debate about how best to chart the course ahead. Our speakers today will focus on a variety of issues and talk about them, but two areas in particular that are relevant to the debate are the distinctions between the approach of carbon tax versus a cap and trade system. In addition, given his research at Vanderbilt, Professor Vandenberg will discuss the role that individuals and businesses will play in efforts to reduce carbon emissions. While they come from different perspectives, I trust that we'll also find several areas of common ground between our panelists. With that, I'll turn it over to Brooks and ask that he begin the presentation.
Thanks, Jeff. We're very excited about this event, and we appreciate everyone coming here, and we certainly appreciate Professor Vandenberg and Professor Adler. And let me introduce those two, our distinguished speakers, and then they are going to come up here and speak for a few minutes each individually, and then we are going to have a question and answer afterwards. So hopefully we can get all of your questions answered to the extent that you have any. Professor Michael Vandenberg is a professor of law at Vanderbilt University Law School and director of Vanderbilt's Climate Change Research Network. Before joining Vanderbilt's law faculty, Professor Vandenberg was a partner at Latham & Watkins in Washington, D.C., where he established himself as one of the nation's foremost environmental lawyers. He served as chief of staff of the Environmental Protection Agency from 1993 until 1995. He began his career as a law clerk to Judge Edward Becker of the United States Court of Appeals for the Third Circuit in 1987. And Professor Adler is a professor of law and director of the Center for Business Law and Regulation at the Case Western Reserve University of the School of Law. A prolific writer, he is one of the most widely cited academics in environmental law. His articles have appeared in the Harvard Environmental Law Review and Supreme Court Economic Review to the Wall Street Journal in the Washington Post. Professor Adler is the author or editor of three books on environmental policy, including Environmentalism at the Crossroads, published in 1995, and several other book chapters. a regular commentator on environmental and legal issues. He's appeared on numerous radio and television programs, including the PBS NewsHour with Jim Lehrer, NPR's Talk of the Nation, Fox News Channel's O'Reilly Factor and Hannity and Colmes, and Entertainment Tonight. Professor Adler is a contributing editor to National Review Online and a regular contributor to the popular legal blog The Volokh Conspiracy. And I will now introduce Professor Adler to speak for a few minutes.
Thank you. It's certainly a pleasure to be here to talk about this important topic. And it's certainly a very timely topic. Just this past week, we have seen several indications that climate policy is moving ahead full steam. But unfortunately, while I think climate policy is important, and as I will emphasize, I certainly think that changes in policy need to be made, the direction we seem to be moving in is not a particularly good one, and I think we need to think more broadly about what sorts of policies make sense if we're going to deal with the climate change challenge, as well as safeguard other values and priorities that we have. Well, what's happened just this week? Well, on Tuesday, EPA Administrator Lisa Jackson agreed to reconsider a decision by her predecessor on whether greenhouse gases are subject to regulation under something called PSD, or Prevention of Significant Deterioration, a program of the Clean Air Act. This is a program that applies to large new sources of emissions. Typically, we're thinking of large power plants and industrial facilities. And former EPA Administrator Stephen Johnson had said that for these permits, greenhouse gas emissions did not need to be considered. Administrator Jackson agreed to reconsider that position, and also indicated that she has instructed the EPA staff to move ahead with looking at what's called an endangerment finding, which is basically a formal determination that in the EPA's judgment, the emission of greenhouse gases cause or contribute to pollution problems that can reasonably be anticipated to endanger the public health or welfare. It's a finding that EPA will have no problem making. Indeed, I think as most people realize, the finding's probably already been written and merely needs to be fly-specced. Once this finding is issued, which will probably occur between now and April, that will trigger mandatory regulation of greenhouse gases under various provisions of the Clean Air Act, provisions covering new motor vehicles, provisions covering stationary sources, not just under the PSD program, but other programs as well, and will also require the implementation or the creation and implementation of a national ambient air quality standard under the Clean Air Act, something which will present a particularly interesting challenge for regulators at the federal and state level, since the premise of the National Ambient Air Quality Standard program is that you have a national standard that localities are required to meet. And figuring out how states and localities can meet a standard locally for globally dispersed pollutants will be an interesting challenge. It's not the sort of thing that the Clean Air Act was written for, but it is the sort of thing that will be required. Under the PSD program, if greenhouse gases are required to be regulated under that program, currently that program covers about 275 facilities that are permitted at either the state or federal level under that program. By most estimates, that will increase more than tenfold once greenhouse gas emissions are required. And just as a practical matter, neither the EPA nor state agencies have the personnel to deal with that level of increase in the permitting process, and there certainly has not been any effort, certainly at the congressional level, to give them the resources they would need to deal with that sort of requirement. So that's one thing that we've seen that's well underway that we've seen this week. The other thing is that the stimulus bill was signed on Tuesday, and as you may be aware, President Obama flew out to Denver for the signing so that he could tour a local museum's rooftop installation of solar panels and celebrate the accomplishments of some Rocky Mountain area renewable energy companies. One reason for this is that the stimulus bill includes approximately $60 billion, and depending on what you include or don't include, that number can vary, but about $60 billion in energy-related provisions, $5 billion of which is to go for research and development of either alternative energy technologies or carbon sequestration. Now, what's interesting about this is that for many of the programs that are getting stimulus money in the Department of Energy, you're seeing 4, 5, 10-fold increase in their funding, and expectation that this money will go out the door rather quickly so it can have a stimulative effect. And the Department of Energy's record of handling large sums of money in a very short period of time, as the GAO has noted several times, is not particularly good, nor is the DOE's record at developing commercially viable energy technologies through research and development. We spent something like $4 billion on the Synfuels program with very little to show for it. I think most people agree that the Clean Coal program and the Newer Future Gen program has spent tens, if not hundreds of millions of dollars, but have yet to do much to help us meet our energy challenges in a cost-effective and environmentally sound way. I think both the move to go ahead with regulating greenhouse gases under the Clean Air Act and the move to throw more money through traditional means at subsidizing energy research and development are the sorts of strategies we might expect to deal with environmental problems, but they're not the sort of strategies that tend to produce positive results. And I don't think they're the sorts of strategies that will do much to meet the very real climate change challenge that we have ahead of us. Now, it's already been mentioned, I accept that climate change is a real concern. I think it is something that we should be worried about. I have no quarrel with the IPCC projections about the likely effects of a doubling of CO2 concentrations in the atmosphere over the next century. And I'm willing to say that the sorts of reductions that the President has put on the table are what we should be talking about. Those reductions, just so we're all clear, that President Obama endorsed during the campaign, is a reduction in greenhouse gas emissions of 80% by the year 2050. Now, in per capita terms, that means reducing per capita emissions in the United States to levels that probably haven't been seen in this country in at least a century. It means that we would have to emit per capita less than half than is emitted currently in countries like Switzerland and France, countries that are interesting to compare us with because both countries rely very heavily on energy sources that have essentially no carbon emissions, hydropower in the case of Switzerland, nuclear in the case of France. And both countries are relatively dense and compact in terms of their populations. They don't have the wide expanses and transportation needs that are a large contributor to the large per capita greenhouse gas emissions of the United States. But to meet the 80% by 2050 target, our per capita emissions would have to be less than half in either of those countries. We could, just because of the transportation sector, we could all be driving hybrid vehicles in the year 2050. And we wouldn't come anywhere close to an 80% reduction just in transportation emissions. If we want an 80% reduction in household emissions, we need to get our households to the point where they're not using that much more energy than annually used by a water heater, and maybe if you're using really good equipment, a few computers on the side. That's setting aside everything else that we use in our home. Given rates that we see in electricity usage in this country, something I was reminded of on my trip down here when I was in the Charlotte airport for a landowner holdover and couldn't find an outlet anywhere, because outlets that probably 5 years ago were only used at night occasionally by people vacuuming are now all filled all the time, charging our phones, our computers, and so on. We realize that this type of challenge, reducing emissions by 80% by 2050, or perhaps the more modest goal that Senator McCain proposed in the campaign of 65%, by 2050, this is a goal we have no clue how to meet. And it's a goal that we know traditional regulatory strategies and traditional subsidy strategies can't accomplish. Existing and foreseeable technologies won't do it. In fact, Energy Secretary Stephen Chu, just about a week or so ago, pointed out that just for solar power alone to have to play a significant role, its ability or its productive ability is going to have to increase at least fivefold. We have no clue how to do that. We've been throwing billions of dollars at solar research for years. So since I only have a little bit of time and we want to have a productive conversation, let me throw out a few things of what I think we should be doing, and hopefully in question and answers in our discussion I'll be able to elaborate on these a little more. Well, the first thing I would do is we need to do something about what I would characterize as the regulatory train wreck that occurs when we take a statute, the architecture of which was written 30 to 40 years ago, that was designed for regional and localized air pollutants, and try to apply it to the most ubiquitous byproduct of industrial civilization, which is also a globally dispersed pollutant, which is relevant for what kind of control strategies. Greenhouse gas control should not be something that we try and force into the Clean Air Act. And while we're at it, we should also recognize that climate change policy is also not very well made through the Endangered Species Act, which is something we're in the process of doing since the polar bear was listed as a threatened species several months back. A listing which, again, I think was proper under the law, but has policy implications that I think are quite problematic. Second thing we should do is I think we should, rather than dealing with existing regulatory regimes, implement a revenue-neutral carbon tax. Now, not a particularly large one, because I don't think, given our economic conditions and everywhere else, we're willing to stomach a particularly large carbon tax, and also because I don't think that the value or the external costs of carbon emissions are as great as some would project. But we certainly, I think, should replace taxes on income, on excises, on corporations and the like, with a tax on the carbon content of fuels. While we're at it, we could also make other changes in the tax code that decelerate or discourage the replacement of capital infrastructure. And if our goal is to accelerate the rate at which we adopt cleaner and more efficient technologies, we should be aware that rules about depreciation and the like affect the rate at which companies turn over their capital stock. Third thing we should do is we should take the idea of innovation very seriously. And that means instead of doling out subsidies to the same old folks who take millions of dollars and produce very little for it, we should be doing two things instead. One is reducing regulatory barriers to innovation. We should stop regulating offshore wind power as if people are drilling for oil and gas, which is how we're dealing with offshore wind power. We should stop regulating tidal power projects as if they are hydroelectric dams, which is what FERC is trying to do. We should also replace subsidies with prizes. It's something that we used to do. It's something that the British Empire did. It's something that France did. It's something that people like Richard Branson and Progressive Insurance still do, but it's something that can be quite meaningful if done by the federal government. If a $10 million prize for reusable space flight could generate not only a successful innovation, but over $100 million in productive private investment, imagine what we could do with this $5 billion in R&D the stimulus provided if that were, instead of traditional subsidies, were used for prizes. Prizes that are rewards for actually producing something as opposed to gifts in the hope you might develop something for us. And the last thing that we need to do, and something we don't talk about enough, although Mayor Bloomberg just this week did say that this had to be discussed in New York, is we have to take the idea of adaptation seriously. Because like it or not, even if we meet the 80% reduction by 2050, a lot of the climate change we're talking about is already in the climate system. It's going to happen whether we like it or not. And in the Western United States, this means radical changes in the availability of fresh water supplies. In some parts of the world, it's going to mean changes in sea level. In other parts of the world, it's going to mean changes in weather. And if we don't take seriously the fact that those are changes we have to deal with, take seriously that we need more dynamic adaptive systems, we need greater resiliency, it won't matter what we do to try and affect the climate 100 years from now, because in the interim, we'll be bearing lots of costs. So those are the four things we do, and I look forward to discussing these further with you in the discussion. Thank you.
Okay. Well, again, thanks to the Federal Society and to our own Climate Change Research Network for pulling this together, and thanks to the hosts and to the efforts that Jonathan has made to come down here. I think what you'll find is that we disagree on a few issues, but we agree on some core issues. So I want to show some slides and talk to you a little bit about some perspectives on climate. But before I do that, just because I think the whole value here is a dialogue in some ways, let me respond very quickly to a couple points you raised, and hopefully that will help provoke some of the kind of discussion that we're going to have, and I hope you will jump in. We agree that climate change is a real problem. We agree that 80% reductions or something in that range are necessary. It's frightening to think about it, but I think you can argue that some of the recent science suggests that that's not going to do it, even by 2050. We agree that we have no clue on how to get from here to there by 2050. I was just working on a paper on that point right now, and it's a little mind-blowing to think about how you take a world where it is today and you transition it to one which is a world that we value and yet has 80% or more greater climate emission reductions by 2050. I think we probably agree as well that many people are probably too optimistic about how difficult it will be and how expensive it will be to get from here to there. I'm not one of those. We likely disagree on the level of priority and urgency that we should give to near-term carbon emissions reduction. I'm concerned that if we don't do something quite substantial in the next decade or so, the game will be up. I concur with Professor Adler that we need to think about adaptation. But you can't adapt to multiple tens of sea level rise in any meaningful way, and certainly not to abrupt sea level rise, which is what Richard Posner in his book Catastrophe really focused on in many ways. We also agree that the Clean Air Act is not an ideal vehicle for dealing with clean air. It is, in fact, premised on the national standard and local achievement of that standard. We probably disagree on the idea that EPA should nevertheless do the best it can with the Clean Air Act, as we've done with many, many statutes when new problems come up, that it is, in fact, the only tool we have now. And given the fact that we've done nothing on climate change of any meaningful sort for the last two decades, I think the prudent measure is to get EPA started as they're doing, pushing forward with the Clean Air Act. If we come up with a better solution in Congress, great. If that fails, we at least have the congressional authority. Far better to use an imperfect tool than not to deal with climate change, in my view. But we don't disagree that it's an imperfect tool, absolutely. We also probably agree that a carbon tax would be the most efficient way to get from here to carbon emissions reductions. I think most economists would tell you that. I think it helps stimulate innovation. I think most innovation should occur in the private world. I think we're much more effective when we do that than when we use government money to stimulate technological investment. So my guess is we agree on that point. I would also suspect that we would disagree on how big that tax would have to be to achieve the avoidance of the substantial risk of catastrophic climate change. A small gradual tax phased in over time, when we don't understand the elasticity of demand for many of the various different carbon uses, I think is a dangerous thing. I also worry that we spent roughly three decades demonizing the idea of taxes in the first place. Imagine running for president on the theory that you would raise everyone's taxes. I can imagine about three people in this room would have voted for that president. So I worry that if we push the most efficient solution first, with the high probability that it fails, which I think a carbon tax would likely do, because it would become demonized as a tax, even if it's revenue neutral, and therefore not a big government option, and not a net dollar out of anyone's pocket, but someone pushing a tax today is going to be very much up against a very difficult wall on the politics. And so I worry that the notion of a tax, although the very likely most efficient solution, either would be set at too low a level to be meaningful, we would think we would have solved the problem, and then would find that we hadn't, or that we wouldn't even get to the tax situation, at least with the current group. We'd vote them all out of office. We'd try again. A few cycles later, maybe we would get a carbon tax. By then, I think it's probably too late. So those are just some direct responses, because, again, I do think that a dialogue here is our very best effort. But let me show a couple slides, if I may, because I think that the first and most important point is the one that asks, can we even talk about climate change? Is it even possible for us to change minds? And I think one of the best things to say about an event like this, and I very much, again, appreciate the Federal Society and the Research Network together working on this, is a concern I have that, in fact, we talk a lot about climate, but we actually don't change opinion. And let me just give you an example of that that's disturbing in terms of our ability to respond as a society to this problem. In 1995, the IPCC is somewhat equivocal about whether climate is happening, right? Balance of evidence suggests discernible human influence. 6 years later, they become quite a bit more certain. New and stronger evidence, more last 50 years attributable human activities. Then, of course, in the spring of 2007, they become quite emphatic. Warning of climate systems unequivocal. Most observed increase since mid-20th century, very likely meaning at least 90%. A survey of climate scientists that was just released a few weeks ago suggested about 90% of climate scientists agree with the thrust of this statement today. And this report was signed off on by 113 governments, the Bush administration, China, Saudi Arabia. So there are definitely climate skeptics, but I think it's hard not to say this is a consensus of where the science is. And Jonathan and I are not, I'm not going to try to commit you to something that I don't want you to, but we're not debating the science here. The bigger point is, what's happened with public opinion? What does the public believe? Here's research from Riley Dunlop, who's a sociologist. And if you start in 1997, when the IPCC is equivocal, so is the general public, not surprisingly. About half of Republicans and Democrats think, not clear that the effects of global warming have already begun. Right? And there's not a big ideological divide here. It's not seen as an ideological issue. People are just not sure. Well, what happens as the IPCC, hundreds of scientists, again and again become more and more certain and more emphatic? Well, we still have a quarter of all Democrats who don't think that that's true. And most disturbingly, now we've gone down 6% in the number of Republicans that believe that as the science has gotten more certain. It seems to me that what's happened is it's become an ideological issue. We're worried more about the implications of believing that climate change is large than we are actually taking the science as it is and saying, how do we fashion a solution? And I, by the way, am in favor of a small government solution. If you look at the research that I do, I look for different ways in which we can harness the private market and individual behavior to try to achieve these kind of carbon emissions reductions. But I really applaud the organization that sponsored this event today, because I think, to me, as a society, this is the core problem we face. Climate change is hard enough as it is, but the systemic problem is how do we actually approach problems if we view them ideologically, and we pick and choose our facts based on what fits our ideology, not take the facts as they are and then figure out what we're going to do that fits the ideology from a policy perspective. Why am I worried about climate? And I think the core difference that you'll find between where Jonathan and I are on this issue, again, we're surprisingly close in many ways, is my sense of priority and urgency. I don't think we have given climate enough priority, even in an economic downturn. I think it deserves top priority, and I think it needs to be done urgently, which is why I don't favor a gradual carbon tax. Why is that true? It's what economists are starting to call thick tail risks, and that's it, right? We are likely going to double from pre-industrial levels, carbon dioxide equivalent levels in the atmosphere. That would get us to about 550 parts per million, right? We often hear a lot about the uncertainty of the science. Well, we're not really sure. The problem, as the economists have begun to identify in the literature in the last several years, is that's absolutely right, but there's very little uncertainty about whether things will be better than we expect, and a huge amount of uncertainty about whether they'll be worse than we expect. And the 550 gives you an example. These are 2 degrees Celsius across the top in global average temperatures. Arctic temperatures tend to be about twice what global average temperatures are. And degrees Celsius is 1.8 degrees Fahrenheit. So you can kind of run the numbers as a lawyer, math impaired, but I tend to double them to get to degrees Celsius, and then again to get to Arctic temperatures. And you see that at 550, right, if we double, which is where we're headed, right, where do we get? We get a 99% likelihood that we get a 2 degrees Celsius increase. And that's what the EU has set as a target and a goal to try to achieve, not to eliminate the chance of catastrophic climate change. As Jonathan said, we're past that. We need to start doing some adaptation, so long as that adaptation doesn't make us think that adaptation will be adequate. But even if we get there, we still have these thick tail risks. We, at that point, have a 69% chance that we get a 3 degrees Celsius temperature. What is that? Right? Well, you double that once to get to degrees Celsius, not quite, and you double it again to get to what the changes would be in the Arctic. Okay. Now you begin to see what some of these downside risks are. We have a 24% chance that we would have a 4 degrees Celsius. That's roughly 8 degrees average in the globe, and then around the Arctic, 13, 14 degrees, somewhere in that kind of range. You're talking about very major changes. We still have a 7% chance of a 5 degree, and it goes on like that. When you're up in this range, you're no longer talking about small things that we can easily adapt to. You're talking about very substantial sea level changes, substantial shifts in rainfall and climate patterns. And so what motivates me is not what happens here, which I think if this is all that we were up against, then I think gradual change would make enormous amounts of sense. I think we do gradual change better. I think what motivates me is the low probability, high consequence events out here. And by low probability, I mean 7%. You know, would you wear your seatbelt if you thought that 7 out of every 100 times you got in your car you'd have a wreck? Yeah, I think you would, right? And that's the risk of a 5 degrees Celsius temperature increase global average, which we're talking about very major social change. So that's what motivates my own work, is trying to think about how do we reduce the risk, we can't eliminate, but reduce the risk that we have these really big downside effects. So I don't want to take up too much of the time on my affirmative presentation. Let me make one or two more comments, and then let's get to our ability to have a back and forth and sharpen the issues up a little bit. I think even if you think the scientists are all captured, they're all persuaded by research money or groupthink or whatever, you might say, okay, I'm going to put all that aside. Nevertheless, what might I do? Where is the world going anyway? And I think I got the McCain statement wrong. I think you said it was 65%. Somewhere in that range. Obama's roughly 80%, and a lot depends on which baseline you pick, et cetera. But both presidential candidates supported a very substantial reduction. The Warner-Lieberman bill, which got to the floor of the Senate last summer, would have leveled us off in 2012 at 2005 levels and then gotten to roughly 70% levels by 2050. the U.S. Climate Action Partnership, two dozen Fortune 500 firms plus several NGOs, roughly the same goal, about 80%. California has a target of 80 to 85%, Florida 85%, France 75%. The U.S. mayors, including our own, have signed the U.S. Mayor's Climate Protection Agreement, which seeks as a goal to reach the Kyoto level, which is 7% below 1990 levels by 2012, and then an 80% reduction by 2050. The Vatican has set a goal trying to achieve carbon neutrality. They're buying carbon offsets to try to produce net neutral outcomes. And then college and university presidents, hundreds of them, have signed a letter trying to commit to this goal. Again, this is emerging as a largely a consensus goal, and I think what we need to talk about for the rest of the time here is how do we achieve a goal like that? Is there a way to get there? And so one or two quick thoughts. We agree on how difficult this would be. Let me give you one more sense. I like the way Jonathan talked about trying to reach carbon per capita levels of a decade or a century ago or something like that in the United States and less than where Switzerland and France are today. Another way to think about that is what happens in the developing world? It won't make much difference if we cut our emissions and yet China grows the way they have. They put on enough coal-fired power last year to supply all the electric needs of France and the year before all the electric needs of the UK. They increased their carbon emissions 11% last year alone. And yet their per capita income is far below ours. And they have a very strong argument that they should be allowed to get to where we are before we start telling them what to do. Right? So what do you do about that? Well, to get to the kind of levels we need to get to reduce these tail risks that we're talking about, China today is about a fifth or so of U.S. per capita carbon emissions. But we can't simply converge. The whole world needs to go below where China is today in order to get to the kind of levels that we're talking about. That's the magnitude of the problem. And you can see why people sometimes simply go, Jesus, we can't do this. Let's pretend that it's not a problem. It's a truly difficult thing. Now, as we go back and forth in questions, I hope to be able to show you some slides on things that we can do from individual behavior and from the corporate perspective. I can either do that now or we can do it through the questions, whichever approach you'd rather us do. Here's what we think about typically. Do we use the Clean Air Act for regulation? Again, we have a disagreement about that. I think it's an imperfect tool, but it's the one we have and we ought to use it today. We both agree that subsidies in themselves are a bit questionable, but we think that perhaps some kind of positive financial reward is a good thing, whether it's a reward, as you mentioned, or an actual subsidy. I think we both would support a carbon tax, probably a different one, but I tend to worry about the political viability of a carbon tax and what happens in the interim. Because of my concern about a carbon tax, I would support a cap and trade program. Again, not perfect, but far more efficient than a regulatory regime. And what I've been working on with a group of us, some of whom are in the audience here today, is looking at the individual and household sector. Are there some things we could do today on kind of a no-regrets basis to begin to get those carbon emissions reductions? Once a pound of carbon goes into the air today that we could have reduced at net savings today, we're likely going to have to spend money to reduce it in the future. It's going to stay in the atmosphere 25, 50, 100, 200 years. So why not reduce emissions in those places where we can, and why not use corporate supply chains to try to begin to put pressure on the developing countries to come to the table? Just to give you a sense, if you haven't already seen it, Michael Girard, who has just started at Columbia running their Climate Institute and is a partner at Arnold & Porter, has a very valuable set of flow charts out tracking litigation. Just to give you a sense of how much litigation is out here, this is good news for all the lawyers in the room. There's a lot of litigation going on about climate, and there's one slide after another of the amount of litigation out there. And this is a useful website, and you can find it just by looking for global climate change in U.S. law with Michael Girard, or it's climatecasechart.com. Huge amount of litigation. This is just the first of many slides showing the current amount of litigation underway right now. But are there non-litigation options here? One thing to do is to go after the individual and household sector. Individuals and households make up between 32 and 41% of all U.S. greenhouse gas emissions. How much are we doing about them? Almost nothing. Almost nothing. We tend to think that they're not a big part of the problem or that we can't change behavior. That American share, just the individual share, is about 8% of the world total. And that individual share is more than the combined emissions from all sources from Central America, South America, and Africa combined. So we have a huge amount of the problem right in front of us if we can find an efficient way to deal with it. How do we do that? We tend to find the biggest sources and say, well, let's focus our effort there. But it's equally important that we figure out which sources are malleable or plastic. Which ones can we change? An example, we tend to look at the standards for building a house. Instead of saying, well, what about the people using the house? And there's evidence that suggests from published research that the same house can have a 300% different amount of energy use based on the behavior of the individuals in the house. And yet we tend to focus on the house, not the behavior. We look at, in a paper in the UCLA Law Review from this summer, at a range of different behaviors, reducing idling, reducing standby power, which is what a power that gets used when you keep your plasma TV plugged in. It uses about 40% of the energy turned off as it uses turned on. Substituting CFLs from regular light bulbs, setting your temperature back 2 degrees in the winter and 2 degrees forward in the summer, water heater temperature changes, tire pressure, auto filter changes, little things that seem tiny. And we get about 150 million tons as the central number here that could be reduced every year in the United States, each one of these with net financial benefit. That is, you would save hundreds of millions of dollars for each one of these individually, and billions in the aggregate. But none of these are things that we're aggressively doing, a few on the margin. And each one of these would be at far greater savings than the cost per ton of the current Lieberman Warner bill. Can these things make a difference? Well, here's California's per capita electricity use since about 1970, right? And you can see that per capita electricity use can differ. And so this is not just a matter of exporting California's electricity use or carbon emissions overseas. Some of that's happening too. But you can see that a combination of different measures has actually had a substantial effect. California has been roughly flat per capita. The rest of the country's been up here. And I'm sorry to say, but Tennessee is above the rest of the country on this. So we're not in a good place on that. Do these kind of interventions matter? This is during the California energy crisis. And you can see in 2001 the dotted line that comes down here. That's the impact of interventions inducing behavior change in homes in California during the California energy crisis. It can work. Okay, last point. This is sometimes called the McKinsey curve. And it's a slide that shows where the most cost-effective options are. And the frustrating thing, and actually something I wouldn't be surprised if Jonathan and I don't agree on, but is that many of the things that we tend to try to do when we're dealing with climate change, unfortunately, tend to focus over here on the right end of the curve, and many of those are the most expensive things we might possibly do, focusing on the large sources. Again, not opposed to doing that. I think we need to do that. What I don't want us to overlook is that there are an enormous number on the left part of the curve here of changes that we could make with residential buildings, with lighting, with transportation, et cetera, that have net economic benefits that we are not doing right now. And my question is, why not go ahead and do them? If it turns out we're wrong about the science, we'll be happy because we will have saved money. If we're right about the science, we might have bought the time for these other measures to kick in, whether a carbon tax or a regulatory scheme or whatever it might be.
Thank you so much. Professor Adler, do you want to respond to any of that?
I'll just say a few things, because I think it's probably more interesting for everybody to be sharp in a few of the areas where we disagree. First, quickly on the Clean Air Act, I should make clear that I'm not critical of the Obama administration for moving ahead with the Clean Air Act because I think they're legally required to do so. I mean, the Bush administration essentially punted on this issue, but after the Massachusetts versus EPA decision, given all the things the Environmental Protection Agency has itself said about climate change, legally there is no alternative but to make an endangerment finding, and everything else from a regulatory standpoint under the Clean Air Act pretty much follows from there. And so the question is, the policy question is whether or not we want to let that happen or we want to replace it with something else. In terms of quick action, I do think that we differ some there, but part of the reason is because if our real goal is to see reductions of the order of, say, 80% by 2050, then there actually are problems with rushing ahead with certain types of reductions today. How could I say that? Well, if we think about infrastructure, we think about transportation infrastructure, we think about buildings, we think about industrial facilities, we're talking about equipment that we expect to be around, not for years, but for decades. And so if we rush to put something in place now that gives us a 10% reduction, a 15% reduction, or 20% reduction, well, then we might actually be increasing the cost of making greater reductions later than if we were to wait to make the changes when it's actually economic efficient to do so. So premature reductions that are too small to get us really near our targets actually might not help us get that far along. We're not going to, economically, we don't want a situation where we're retrofitting or rebuilding power plants or rebuilding industrial facilities every 5 to 10 years. And so we want to make sure that the timing of our changes are such that we're actually capturing large gains when we can. And if you believe, as I do, that we're nowhere near the sort of technological capacity we need to be at to get the sorts of reductions we're talking about, then pushing now under the Clean Air Act, for example, to force coal-fired facilities and other facilities to make changes now is actually not really helping us get towards the target and makes it more likely that we'll be in a situation where we spent lots of money on reductions but didn't achieve anywhere near the reductions necessary to make a difference, and so we actually end up with the worst of both worlds. A couple other quick points. On no-regrets policies, I'm all in favor of them. There are lots of little things we could do. Improving air traffic control and modernizing air traffic control and allowing more direct flight by pilots can actually reduce fuel use by airplanes. We can do things like that. But we will disagree about the McKinsey study. We will disagree about whether or not there are all these free lunches out there. Because the reality is that people have always been able to change their thermostats, and they don't. Why? Because they believe, in many cases, that it is worth the extra money to have their house a little cooler in the summer or a little warmer in the winter. They'd rather not put on the sweater, as a president some decades ago advised them to do. And unless we think there is some magical way to change consumer behavior through shaming or something else, we have to recognize that the reason these things aren't occurring now is because in real terms, they're not free. They may save money, but they require sacrifices of other things that people value. So in true economic terms, they're not free. Similarly, in the corporate sector, the fact that a given investment produces a positive return is not what's important. What's important is that it produces a greater return than available alternative investments. If stocks are giving you one return and bonds another, bonds aren't a good deal because the return is positive if stocks would give you a higher return. Obviously, in the current economic climate, that's probably not the best example, but I think you get the point.
Less of a loss, is that
right?
A better thing?
But the point is that from a corporate perspective, there are always more net positive potential investments that out there than can actually be made. And so the goal is to identify those that produce the greatest returns, and if there are positive returns in energy efficiency that are less than other possible investments, they actually do entail a cost. If we're interested in encouraging people to capture the low-hanging fruit, we need to deal with the price of energy. I think the best way to deal with that is a carbon tax. I do believe it's more politically viable than Michael suggests, because if it's done in a revenue-neutral way, unlike perhaps the way that was suggested, for example, by the Clinton administration with their BTU tax, that does make a big difference. It makes a big difference because there are many folks in the political right that for years have been saying that we should move away from taxing income towards taxing consumption. So there is political viability, and also because cap and trade system is, whether we like to admit it or not, a tax. It's just a hidden tax. It's just a very complex tax. It's just a tax that we know from the European experience is going to probably not produce a lot of the changes that we want, because Europe's emission trading scheme has been a disaster, because of the compromises they had to make it politically viable essentially blew up the market. And a cap and trade system also, from a political economy standpoint, is a feeding frenzy of rent seeking. I mean, if you think that earmarks are bad and things like that are bad, just wait till we're asking congressional committees to write rules about how we give credit to certain types of activities and across industrial sectors and across different types of fuels and what types of life cycle analyses we will use to credit properly. It will be a nightmare. And we know that from existing emission trading regimes that something of the scale and the complexity of a cap and trade for carbon is a monstrous undertaking. And we don't have, at least no reason to believe, we have the sorts of shortcuts that would make it cost effective that existed in the context, say, of the sulfur trading regime that was used for acid rain, where you had a fairly traditional pollutant, you had essentially under 500 participants, only 500 entities that were involved. You had relatively easy verifiability. You didn't have the same sorts of life cycle issues. You had cost savings that could be produced through things that had nothing to do with altering your fuel use. So, for example, most of the cost savings in the SO2 program resulted from cost reductions in transportation that came about through the transportation deregulation. It had nothing to do with the actual architecture of the trading regime. So cap and trade is one of those things that looks great in theory, but is much harder for us to implement in practice. And so if we're going to have a tax, my view is let's have a direct, transparent, clear, revenue-neutral tax, rather than have the sort of tax which I think would delegitimize the idea of carbon control politically, because once we see what it unleashes from a rent-seeking standpoint, it'll be a nightmare. And that relates to the last point I wanted to make on public opinion. Why is public opinion diverged? I'd say it has for two reasons. One is because there are a lot of people out there that believe that the ends justify the means in sort of scenarios they paint. So you have Jim Hansen, well-respected scientist at NASA, running around saying that the problem is that he literally wrote this in an op-ed published a couple weeks ago, that the problem is that world governments aren't listening to him, and that we're allowing death factories, by that he means coal plants, to continue to operate. Because we have award-winning films like The Inconvenient Truth, which whatever you think about climate change, was riddled with errors, riddled with misstatements, riddled with exaggerations. And it's like we've seen in lots of areas. If you oversell something for long enough, people start to not believe you. You cry wolf enough, people don't believe there are any wolves out there. Well, the reality is there is a wolf. We can disagree about how big it is or how likely it is to come around the corner or how soon it's going to arrive. But it's there. But we've been told so many stories about wolves far larger, far more imminent, far more ferocious than the real one that's there, that the public, large portions of the public have become skeptical. And then you add to that, we pretend as if what is a value-laden policy debate is a science debate. We pretend as if once we settle the science, everything else follows. And that's false. Science informs our discussion. It lets us know what our options are, lets us know the consequences of those options, lets us know the threats we face, but it doesn't tell us what to do about it. It doesn't tell us what trade-offs to make. And so the combination of those two things has understandably made the public, or portions of the public, less willing to believe this. And you add to that the fact that we've had folks out there, former Undersecretary of State Tim Wirth, famous for saying, oh, we got to sell, and I'm paraphrasing, but he essentially said, we've got to sell this because the things we're going to do to stop climate change would be good things to do anyway. So we should, and people start to hear that, and they start to see overstatements that are easily falsifiable, and they become skeptical. And I think that's unfortunate, because we need to be having a serious substantive debate about how to deal with what is essentially a really vast, really complex risk problem. And the way we tend to discuss it in the political context really short-circuits the ability to have that discussion.
Well, may I engage? Back?
You
I think we're on the right track here.
So
now we can actually have a real disagreement, if we may. So I completely disagree with the science on Inconvenient Truth. There are some shortcomings there, but the basic scientific response is he's on target. He may have understated the case in some places. Absolutely, you'll find some people. Go find a peer-reviewed paper that picks apart the core pieces of the message of Inconvenient Truth.
I'll send people sites if people want peer-reviewed data that dispute. Yeah. Because, I mean,
let me give you an example of the kind of thing that I'm seeing, and I've seen climate skeptics do this with Inconvenient Truth, and it drives me wild. So the most recent IPCC report, what does Al Gore say about sea level rise? He says, maybe 20 feet, and he shows us these dramatic pictures of Manhattan going underwater. And climate skeptics have slides out there that they circulate that show, oh my goodness, Al Gore's trumping up 20 feet. He's nuts because the IPCC says that the top end of the sea level increase will be 0.43 meters by 2100. See, Al Gore is nuts. What's the top end of 0.43 meters? About 2 feet. Al Gore says 20 feet. The group of scientists that he supposedly relies on says 2 feet. Right? Well, read the report. What does the report say? That says we cannot model the breakup of the ice sheets, which is the principal reason why sea levels might rise as much as they might. Right? So, sure, if you exclude the principal reason why sea levels might rise a great dramatic amount, you get 0.43 meters. But they're explicit about it. They say, we don't know. And what does the data say since the release of the IPCC report? These are in peer-reviewed studies. If you're doing climate science and you're looking at blogs as your source of information, think about going to a doctor sometime. And the doctor sits you down, and he says, your drinking is causing your liver problem. I consulted. 98% of the doctors who published in this field have said, you're going to die. But two say you might not. Right? Do you stop drinking or do you keep drinking? Right? I think we're still drinking. These are studies that have come out since the IPCC report that are published in peer-reviewed journals that show, since the IPCC report, melting of Arctic sea ice, worse than expected. Increase in melting Greenland, that's the ice sheet breakup, worse than expected. So substantial ice mass in Antarctica. This is a skeptic's great thing. Oh, Antarctica, sea ice is growing more than expected, right? George Will has a column in last weekend's Washington Post where he says, you know what? There is an institute that has recently said that the Arctic sea ice is actually not shrinking. And so all these climate skeptics or all these climate alarmists are off base. Within a day, that same institute said, we don't know where he's getting his data. Okay? This is a slide from Walt Meyer, who's at the Ice and Snow Center in Boulder, Colorado. This is the least extent of the sea ice at the end of the summer of 1979 on the left. That's Alaska, and that's roughly the North Pole below that sun. Why does that matter? When sea ice has snow on it, it reflects roughly 90% of the sun's energy. What's the slide on the right? Same time, end of the summer, in 2007. Now you can almost take a ship to the Arctic and back without hitting sea ice. How much of the sun's energy does the sea absorb? 60%. Right? 60 to 90%. So you go from having the Arctic be a great mirror to a great sponge. Right? Those are the kind of events. Does that raise sea levels? Absolutely not. It just happens to be next to Greenland, which has as much water in it as all the Gulf of Mexico, which would raise sea levels 20 feet or so. So anyway, if you want to disagree, we disagree a lot on that. We disagree on whether the thrust of the science behind An Inconvenient Truth is correct or not.
But that's not, the claim is not that the thrust is right. The claim is not that the projection that we are warming or the claim that we are warming the planet and will continue to do so is wrong. The point is that specific claims, specific slides, specific things are out of the evidence. And so what happens is that he doesn't say, we don't know about ice sheet breakup, which is the true answer, right? We don't know. There is a huge uncertainty of potentially serious negative consequences. He doesn't say that.
Right.
He says, this is what they tell us will happen.
That's an important difference.
That
degree of certainty can affect your credibility.
And so if you run around saying, there's a big difference if you run around saying, look, there is a big risk that we might face that we've got to prepare for. It's very different from saying, this is exactly what's going to happen. If we think about the Cold War, big difference from saying the Russians are ready or the Soviets are ready to fire their nukes and saying, look, it's a dangerous, uncertain world. We have to prepare for certain eventualities. Overstating the certainty of a risk, overstating the magnitude of a known risk, reduces credibility.
And I would be more worried about the way Al Gore does that if it weren't the case that there are people out there who are funded every day to increase in the public's mind the sense of uncertainty. Right. So the problem is, I'm glad. I mean, Jonathan and I think can have a really substantive discussion on this. And I want to get to another point, but I think one of the concerns is that then the public sort of tunes everyone out, and then we end up in a place where no one's listening and changing their minds. Let me just say one thing about. I think the point is an interesting one about all we need to do is raise the price of energy, and people will begin to respond efficiently. Well, you need proper information to do that. And one of the people in the audience here is a graduate student who led a study on motor vehicle idling. We've conducted the first study of how much people idle in the United States today and what they believe about idling. So let's assume for the moment that you increase the price of gas. Are people going to respond rationally to that? Are they going to change their behavior? Well, most people in the United States today believe to save gas, you should idle for 4.7 minutes. Okay? If you want to prevent pollution, they think you should idle for only 3.6 minutes at least. Or prevent vehicle wear, 5.7 minutes. Right? After that, cut your car off and save yourself some money. Okay? What's the actual truth? Right? Clearly less than 30 seconds. Major regulatory agencies suggest less than 10 seconds when your car is warm and less than 30 seconds when your car is cold. So here's a case where, and I'm not naive about this, and I think Jonathan has a good point, that we're not going to get from here to 80% reductions with this, but why not correct people's myths about idling? It's a simple thing. Have you ever driven down West End and gotten caught in the traffic jam as people wait to get into the Starbucks? Right? About 90% of those folks think they're doing something good for the environment most of the time. They're sitting there idling with their cars running. I went to a climate change talk the other night where there were 10 cars idling in the parking lot as I walked in. I almost cried, but I couldn't. That gives you one example. Let me say that the same thing occurs. Although we believe that markets are efficient, they're efficient to an extent. And here's two just examples. These are absolutely sort of high-end examples, but you know we're in a conversation. There is a company in England that's been buying its potatoes by the pound. So what do the farmers in England do? Right? They pick their potatoes when they're wet. They transport them while they're wet. They humidify the warehouses to keep them wet, and then they sell heavy potatoes. What does the potato chip manufacturer do? They dry out the potatoes before they make the potato chips. Now, why did that system develop? It developed because we've been in an economy for hundreds of years now with cheap fossil fuels. Right? Would they have found those inefficiencies and those carbon emissions had we not had higher-priced oil? I don't know. Have we not put a price on carbon? Have we not provided information? I don't know. Is price enough? I don't think so. I think you need to not only raise the price, but you've got to deal with the information problem. Second quick example, and this is a way that that consumer behavior may change corporate behavior. You could at one point buy little trays of mini vegetables in England that were sold for the high-end market that had little carrots and little broccolis tied up with a chive, and those were grown in England, air freighted to Nairobi, Kenya, where people at low labor rates were tying the chives around them, shrink-wrapped, and air freighted back to London again. Now, if we had a concern about carbon emissions, would we do that? Would the high-end customers in England, where climate change is the number one issue, by the way, in the U.S. it's 20 out of 20, at least in survey, it's number one in England in many surveys, would those customers have bought that product? No? But would we, many of us in the U.S., object to carbon labeling a product? Yeah, we're going to talk about how the transaction costs are high. We're going to talk about how inefficient it is. We're going to wonder whether we really need to do so. So my thought is simply, it's time to bear some costs. And let's bear those costs in those places where it's most efficient to do so, where we can preserve a small government option, where we can preserve consumer autonomy. But let's give consumers the information. High prices alone, in the absence of good information, don't achieve the kind of outcomes we want.
Why don't we open up some questions?
So given how draconian the emissions cuts are going to have to be, 80%, and given how...
Well, that's only by 2050. We'll have to keep going after
all right.
That. Yeah, that's the bad news.
Worse. And so given how expensive that's probably going to be, I'm curious why both of you seem to dismiss so quickly the alternative of adaptation. And in particular, I'm wondering, has anyone sat down and calculated how expensive it's going to be to make these emission reductions and compared it to how expensive it's going to be to adapt by protecting our cities from rising waters or moving our cities from rising waters? Has anyone looked at the costs on both sides so we know that we're actually doing the least costly thing by trying to achieve these emissions?
I think we can both answer that. The answer is yes. There are very sophisticated analyses. Nordhaus at Yale is one of the best known. Stern in England has done his own work. We all can agree or disagree with different versions of it. I actually, we're at a Federalist Society meeting, so I had to bring a book by Richard Posner. And he has a great book called Catastrophe out there. And Posner makes it clear in the book that he's not simply being an environmentalist here. There's lots in this book that makes it clear that he's not sympathetic to many environmentalist viewpoints, but he looks clearly and cleanly at this issue and says the abrupt nature of the change that might occur makes it very difficult for us to adapt in some successful way. So I think we probably agree that some level of adaptation is absolutely necessary. We have enough radiative forcing built into the system already that we're going to get some change. The question that I keep coming back to on some level is, so I think we need to adapt, how do we account for the idea that we might get to the place in a few decades where we have enough carbon in the atmosphere that we have built into the system not sea level rises that will occur right away, but the knowledge that in the next century, two centuries, three centuries, we'll have tens of feet of sea level rises. Big parts of Florida go away, big parts of many of the areas we value. How do we really value that? And there are studies that make those calculations, and at some point, does a discount rate account for our obligation to the future? If the founders, which the Federalist Society is obviously interested in the thinking of the founders, if they had designed something into the Constitution that they could have prevented for $10 billion or whatever that would cause an implosion of the government 200 years later, how would we look at them today? And that's, to me, on some level, the near-term costs matter a lot, but I think the irreversibility of the harm and the magnitude of the potential harm, even if it's a 1 in 100 risk or whatever, is very hard to get your arms around in terms of simply saying, well, I'll only pay a small amount today or I'll simply adapt. I don't think you can actually adapt to a multiple tens of feet sea level rise in any meaningful way.
We would disagree on that. I mean, let me say a couple things. First of all, I think we'll step back. I mentioned the founders. I teach tomorrow morning. I'll be teaching my constitutional law class, one of the classes that I teach. And the primary document that we're talking about is a little over 200 years old. And we're talking seriously as if today we can do things with any amount of foresight about what's going to happen 100 to 200 years from now. That's mind-boggling. Right? Imagine having a policy discussion about environmental policy in 1909 and talking about what the world will or won't look like, what the real environmental problems will or won't be. 1909, around the time of the first electric car race, when people thought that that was really going to be the mode of individual transportation, was going to be electric vehicles. We can't plan how we're going to deal with environmental changes many decades in the future. We have to recognize it. But we do know there's this big risk. There are uncertainties about it. I think we have to be honest about those uncertainties and upfront. And I think, you know, that my response view is, when people stress uncertainty, is yes, there's uncertainty. All risk problems involve uncertainty. We don't not do things because of uncertainty. We acknowledge the uncertainty, and we figure out how to minimize that cost or minimize those risks at an acceptable cost. And that can't happen in this context without technological innovation, which is why I think we've got to focus on that. It's also something that expands our options, right? If we can accelerate the rate at which we develop certain types of technologies by increasing the returns for certain types of investments and certain types of innovations, it's what prizes do. It's the most effective government-sponsored way of encouraging innovation, with the possible exception of the patent system, that has ever been devised. And if you think anywhere, you're in an area where you want primarily the public good characteristics of technological innovation, you don't want to rely on the patent system, because the patent system relies upon giving someone a private monopoly. We should be focusing our efforts in that direction. On the adaptation side, we all the time see situations in which societies, communities have to deal with very dramatic, very sudden changes. And there are some things we know about that. There's some things we know about what makes a community more resilient and more adaptive. And it tends not to be lots of regulation. It tends not to be lots of top-down government control. It tends not to be poverty. And so, insofar as we bear lots of costs now and we impose lots of restrictions now, we have to be very careful we are not doing things that reduce our resilience and reduce our adaptive capacity. And so I think focusing on price signals through tax and carbon, so that on the margin we are creating incentives to take advantage of whatever innovations and opportunities are available, is a smart thing to do that doesn't constrain our adaptive potential. Focusing on innovation. And then when it comes to adaptation, we need to be realistic about the fact that 80% by 2050, actually, it's possible, might not be doable. It might not. I'm an optimistic guy. I tend to think if we do the right policies, it will be achievable. But we want to have a menu of policies that recognizes that adaptation is something that we're going to have to do, and we don't know how much of it we're going to have to do. And we want, and it has to be adapting to an uncertain future, not a certain future. And so, to take one really concrete example that's relevant for the U.S., and I'm going to make one other tiny point that I know, I think Michael's screwed. We'll see. Concrete point on adaptation. Let's look at water. In the Western United States, huge issue. We're already overusing available fresh water supplies in the Western United States. We're already in virtual drought conditions almost permanently in parts of the Western United States. We have a massive infrastructure in place that is ill-suited to changes in, for example, the rate and timing of precipitation and snowmelt. A lot of the water in the Western United States is from snowmelt. Depending on when the snow occurs and when it melts, you can have big. Now, there are two ways we can deal with this. We can build more infrastructure. Well, that only works if we think we know precisely how the precipitation is going to change, how the weather is going to change, how the water availability is going to change. Well, the IPCC says we have no clue. All we know is that it's going to change a lot. And it's going to change in some directions in some places, in other directions in others. And so change is what we know, but not the precipitation. So one thing is what we've been doing for the last several decades. The alternative is to develop complex adaptive systems, what Bob would refer to as water markets, which we know work, which we know operate, which are very good at very quickly processing information about different needs at different times and different places, and at dealing to relatively sudden changes. Far more effective at dealing with sudden changes than top-down alternatives. Both are imperfect. Both are going to fail. But one is putting in place an adaptive system that actually has a chance of dealing with uncertain sudden changes. Relying on what we've done in the past gives us no prayer of that. Last point on your initial point about cost of adaptation versus cost of climate change. one thing that's really interesting and that people don't like to talk about is that the effects of climate change and the risks of climate change are not evenly distributed. And Cass Sunstein, our soon-to-be director of OIRA, has a paper out that's called something like A Tale of Two Countries or something like that, that basically points out that the two most countries for climate change purposes are the United States and China. And the United States and China also happen to be the two countries for which the deal of greatly reducing emissions to prevent climate change is the worst. That is to say, China and the United States, on net, are two of the smaller losers from climate change because of increases in agricultural productivity, reduction in heating costs and other things like that, that you set reductions in heat-related mortality. When you compare those things against effects of climate change, reduction in coal-related mortality as opposed to increases in heat-related mortality. But they're also China and the U.S., the countries that are going to bear the greatest cost, at least in the short term, of emission control. And that creates an interesting policy problem. And I happen to think that we actually do have a moral obligation to not do things that cause tremendous negative effects in parts of the world that don't face that same trade-off, right? There are parts of the world that have done next to nothing to contribute to climate change that, to put it somewhat crudely, really get screwed in the sense that, low-lying tropical countries are already in economic terms experiencing super-optimal temperatures. That is to say, their temperatures are already hot, greater than what we would think of as optimal temperatures, and we're going to increase them even further. And they don't get much of the economic benefits of that because they're not the ones producing the stuff. So I think that's a relevant normative concern. But the reality is, many parts of the United States, parts of Canada, large parts of Russia, large parts of China, it's hard to say in the next 50 years that the cost just to the United States or just to, say, Canada of emission reductions are small, of the magnitude we're talking about, are smaller than the cost of climate change. And that's just something we have to own up to.
If I may, just let me show you a couple of slides really quickly about China, because I think they follow on very nicely to that. And I apologize that you got two law professors here, so we like to listen to questions, but we like to listen to ourselves talk more than that. Just to give you a quick sense of the China problem, because this is in some level the heart of the problem. There's both a Pareto optimality issue. How do you make each country want to engage in an agreement? And there's a justice question. What do you do with the fact that there's much more poverty in China and India and other countries than there is elsewhere? How do you deal with those two together? And just to give you a sense of the different ways to think about this problem, this is in the year 2005 in terms of flows of carbon. Who has put the most carbon into the air on a year-by-year basis? The USA in 2005 was 20.5%, China 18%. Okay, now if you did this 2 years later, now China would be bigger than the US. The US percentage would go down, not because our emissions went down, but because China went up so fast. So in terms of flows, they're now bigger than we are. Okay, but if you're in China, are you going to see the problem this way? And I think the answer is no, you're going to see it this way. This is per capita carbon emissions in China. And here you see the U.S. is 20 tons per person if you just take all emissions and you divide it by our population. And China is 4, right? So one-fifth. That's the way they're going to look at the problem. The next way they're going to look at the problem is this way, which is stocks of carbon. Carbon stays in the atmosphere for a while. How much of the stock of carbon in the atmosphere have we each contributed to? That's what ultimately is driving radiative forcing. And here you see the U.S. is close to 28% and China close to 8%. And so if you're actually at the table having these arguments, this is the fight that's going on. And we don't solve this problem unless both the U.S. and China do it. And what we've done for the last decade or maybe 20 years is to say to the Chinese, you better reduce your carbon emissions. And they said to us, you better reduce yours. And we've both kind of happily gone along, neither one doing it. And that's not going to cut it. And I have a paper out there called The China Problem on the table if anyone's interested, where I look at a way to use supply chain contracting as a way to push Walmart alone, for example, does $17 billion a year with China alone. When Walmart says we want to buy products that are more energy efficient, less carbon intensive, it has a real effect on Chinese manufacturers and the Chinese government. Again, it's not the only solution, but it's a way that private industry can make a difference.
Do you have a slide of emissions per unit of GDP?
I don't.
That's interesting, because mm-hmm. that's the sort of efficiency slide looks pretty good compared to China, compared to the developing countries. And if you control for things like, if you control for geography, the United States actually ends up looking pretty good with most of Europe as well. One of the problems with comparisons, international comparisons for units of GDP is that there's no Montana in the middle of Europe, or there's no vast expanses where you have the same transportation needs. But the fact that we have such greater our ratio of emissions to unit of GDP is so much better or lower than much of the rest of the world does mean that there are opportunities to perhaps negotiate with other countries where part of what we're putting on the table is the ability for them to be as efficient as we are. I mean, if you look at the way China produces steel, for example, I mean, it's and I forget the exact year, but it's like the equivalent of what we were doing. I'm making up a number, but decades ago. I mean, they are producing steel as if all the efficiency improvements we've made were not discovered because it's a quick and easy way to do it. But imagine if the U.S. government, for example, said, we will... the U.S. government either voluntarily purchased or acquired through eminent domain international patent rights for certain production technologies and agreed to give them to China in return for certain pledges to deploy certain types of technologies. We could see significant gains in China that would not, particularly in terms of the projected growth in China, which is tremendous as China races to become more prosperous. But that wouldn't really come at a cost to China, and would be come at much less cost to us than some of the other things that are on the table. And that's the sort of thing which I think people do talk about, but it is something we should talk more about because there are real gains there to be made from helping other parts of the world adopt energy saving technologies that we take for granted, particularly in the industrial sector.
Unfortunately, we're almost out of time. I would suggest
you got a question in the back. I don't know you.
Oh, we'll take some questions. We'll take a few until we talk. We're done.
I want to make sure I understand your individual points. It sounds to me like Professor Vandenberg is saying that we need to do what we can now, efficiencies, maybe household efficiencies, and we also need to be looking down the road to the significant changes that we need to make in our energy sources, efficiencies, uses, so that we can get to 80% reduction by 2050. Sounds to me like you're saying that you're concerned that money that goes into little changes now that we know aren't going to reach that 80% could potentially be wasted money. So instead, we should really be focusing on just those things that can get us to that 80%. But at the same time, I heard you saying that we have no idea what that might be.
Well, I mean, one of the things today that increase the likelihood that we'll be able to reach that 80%. So what do I mean by that? I mean by figuring out ways to create greater incentives to reduce energy use in ways we can do now, as well as greater incentives to figure out, to innovate in ways that we need to do. And so the things that I would be talking about doing now is revenue neutral carbon tax, because on the margin, higher energy prices are going to result in reductions in energy use, are going to result in greater incentives to develop energy saving technologies. And then also through things like prizes. And just to make clear what I'm talking about, the Ansari X Prize, just because that was one that Richard Branson, I guess, funded and got a lot of attention, he's only going to give $10 million to the first person that can develop a way to do develop a reusable spacecraft. And all these people spent millions and millions of dollars and actually figured out all kinds of neat things, and someone took home the prize. $100 million of private investment was spurred by this prize. And we got lots of useful things. When the British Empire needed better navigation, this is what they did. When the French government needed better food preservation technology for its troops, this historically, we realized that the way you get innovation is not by giving a big pot of money to a government lab and saying, work on this. It's guaranteeing super competitive returns or really big reward to whomever can solve a problem. And so if we're serious about the magnitude of this problem and the sort of technological leaps we need to do everything we can to increase the reward of solving those problems. And if you look at the magnitude of the sorts of things we throw around in energy subsidies, there's a lot of money there. There's a lot of money that could induce a lot of private innovation. It's the same principle the patent system works under. Right? You get super competitive returns when you develop something that's patentable because you get a temporary monopoly. Well, it's almost like the patent system on steroids. Except we're assuming it'll be in the public domain. That's the condition for the prize. So that, combined with all changes in energy prices, I think increase our opportunities and increase the likelihood that we're going to be able to do 80% by 2050, as well as the additional reductions we're going to need beyond that, which Mike and I haven't really talked much about. I mean, that 80% by 2050 is just step one.
That's the happy story. And the sad story is that the atmosphere and the oceans and all absorb less carbon over time as they get saturated, and so you need to approach a zero level at some point. But let's all hope that that's far enough down the road that we'll get there. The only thing I would differ from Jonathan on is I think it's not enough just to do prizes. I think that's a nice idea, and I'm cautious about government's ability to pick technology. I think we have to be very cautious about that. But there are some times when funding basic systemic research is necessary, that no one person's working in a lab is necessarily going to solve the problem. It may take teams of people. It may take advances in basic research, which are hard to do on an individual level. So I think some combination of these kinds of incentives are worth trying, and I think the problem's big enough that we should do it.
But I say, you know, if the history of prizes, especially something like the Ansari X Prize, showed that. I mean, you had corporations funding teams. You had some crazy people in their garages, but you also had corporations. And sometimes it was done because they wanted the prize, and there were some teams that spent more than the value of the prize because they just wanted the PR benefit of saying, we're the ones that figured this out. If you compare it to the way our regulatory process works, where if your technology is anointed the best available control technology, you win. It's very hard for other technologies to break in, and so you get a regulatory process that essentially locks in a technology that might be a little better than where we are now, but at the cost of really discouraging everything that could come next. You combine that with the way the regulatory process effectively grandfathers facilities in, you essentially say to people, don't change your facility, don't make it more efficient, because if you do, you're going to have to retrofit it. So if you can squeeze an extra 5 years out of a 30-year-old power plant that's as dirty and inefficient and whatever, as do it, because the second you make big changes, you've got to redo everything. That, on top of the kind of the technological lock-in, really discourages people from taking advantage of gains they can take advantage of. Now, obviously, there are trade-offs, and I don't know if you were at EPA when the beginning process of looking at this problem in NSR began. But this is something we realize is a problem, and we have to be wary of.
We could fight about NSR, and I'd be more sympathetic if I thought that the changes in the rulemaking
would drive plants to be cleaner. I'm not defending the administration changes.
Instead of keep them dirty, but that's for another day.
It's not that it doesn't materialize quickly enough. It's that it doesn't produce. I don't think it produces the sorts of reductions that come anywhere close. And so we end up with a situation where we spend a lot of money and we get the climate change, which is, I think, is a lose-lose proposition. We can't get to 80% with existing technologies.
Right, but what if somebody doesn't come up with
then we are still in the same place and we haven't wasted lots of resources. Well, no, we have resources to deal. We have resources that we can still devote to adaptation and those sorts of things. I mean, we don't have an infinite amount of resources to invest. And my argument is we should be investing in those things that maximize the likelihood that we can actually achieve our goal in a cost-effective way. And that happens not to be using the tools that serve us well in other environmental contexts. And because the reality is that if we come up with the sorts of technological breakthroughs that we're talking about, we won't need government to push them. I mean, gasoline replaced electricity for motor vehicles like that when those issues came along. Kerosene replaced whale oil like that. Fiber optics replaced cotton. I mean, you can look example after example. If the innovation is great enough, the rate of adoption in the marketplace is dramatic. I mean, we can all talk about our wireless PDAs. I mean, so what we want is we want a system that's going to encourage the likelihood of that innovation and encourage incentives to move in that direction. And I think that's going to maximize our opportunity. And the alternative, you know, historically has not led to a lot of technological innovation, hasn't led to the sorts of things that we know we need. Because I would actually say there are folks out there that would say that the IPCC's projections of the climate emissions we need are significantly lower than what we actually need. Well, if that's true, if we're not focusing on innovation, then even 50% by or 80% by 2050 doesn't put us in a better place.
Right, my point is simply that taking the carbon out of the air at a low cost or net positive economic effect now buys us a little bit of time. We have a paper coming out soon that will suggest that we could reduce emissions from the individual and household sector, which is now, again, 30 to 40% of the total U.S. share, by, you know, maybe 20% or so through the kinds of things that I'm mentioning up here. Is it huge? No, not in and of itself. It's bigger than any one industrial sector, though. I mean, and my thought is, why not try that? Buy us the time. Let's get those early gains. And then it's going to take a while for this technology to jump in. I don't disagree with a lot of what Jonathan has said about the need to develop a new technology. We don't get from here to there without it. And the only question is, do we do some things between now and then to reduce the risk? And every time you take a pound of carbon out of the air, we don't know where those tipping points are. You slightly reduce, and we don't know how much, the risk that will have some kind of catastrophic effect.
This has been absolutely fantastic. I really appreciate both of you all going on and on. And thank you, everybody. And sorry, we're out of time, so we're going to have to wrap up. But I'm sure that Professor Vandenberg and Professor Adler will be willing to stay and answer questions afterwards.
Absolutely.
But otherwise, we'd like to just thank the Federalist Society as well as the Vanderbilt Climate Change Institute.
Research Network.
Research Network. Yeah. Research Network for putting this on and sponsoring this, and appreciate both of you for this fascinating dialogue.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Enjoy it. Yeah.